Delmer's antennas twitched with amusement. You are not going to believe this. That is impossible, Vinny declared flatly. A broken star carrier had jumped under the control of a Ruhar ship? A Ruhar ship commanded by a human? Vinny's mind reeled at the idea of a lowly human being in command of anything more complicated than a rowboat. His gambler's brain pounded at the unlikeliness of a broken star carrier jumping at all, and that the jump controller had been developed by the Ruhar. He would have wagered everything he had that neither of those events could have been possible. Yet according to the flight recorder log certified as accurate by the Deal Me In's former crewman Arlon Dahl, it had been the clever thinking and initiative of the human called Emily Perkins that saved both her old Ruhar cruiser, the life of Arlon Dahl, and the aft section of the Deal Me In. It happened. Therefore it is not impossible, Delmer retorted. Do you want to bet on it? No, Vinny replied automatically, as he had lost too many wagers to his sister-in-law. Amory, we need to follow that... What could he call it? The thing that had jumped away from the battle space was not a star carrier, and the Ruhar training ship was not capable of jumping a useful distance. Follow what is left of the Deal Me In. What? Why? Amory was wary of another scheme from Vinny. We have proof that we found the missing ship. We found part of the missing ship. Those sleazy bureaucrats at Central Wagering will use any excuse to cut our winnings, you know that. Darling, we can follow easily. There is less danger going into Kristang space than there is for us being here. When we locate the ship and the one crewman who survived, Vinny knew there would be a bonus if they could bring back Arlon Dahl. The fleet will surely forgive all past transgressions we've committed. Allegedly committed. Plus, Vinny was getting wound up with enthusiasm. That training ship is full of cadets. The Ruhar will reward us well for bringing back their precious children. You hope. I believe. This is a sure thing. Amory put her hands on her hips, and Vinny knew what that meant. Like all your sure things before? This is different. Different how? This time, you agree with me. Vinny flashed a winning smile. Amory sighed. Maybe you're right. This one time, mind you. Besides, there's one thing you forgot.
What is that?
A Ruhar ship controlled one of our jump drives. The Ruhar fleet will pay dearly for the knowledge of how that happened.
Thelmer and Cleeters agreed wholeheartedly, even enthusiastically, to the idea of following the Deal Me In. All four aboard were greedily imagining their cuts of the wager and rewards money, and all four were burning with curiosity to learn whether the aft end of the Deal Me In had successfully jumped or had exploded into a million pieces. For another species, agreement and curiosity would have been enough to settle the issue. For the Giraptha, those factors merely served as an opening for renegotiating their financial arrangements and to set side wagers on whether the broken star carrier had in fact survived a jump, and had jumped more than once, had flown through a wormhole, had arrived at a Kristang-controlled star system. There were other wagers on how many, if any, of the cadets and other crew would still be alive when the sure thing arrived. Vinny allowed the dickering back and forth to continue, both because he couldn't resist getting in on the action, and because work to inspect and repair the ship's jump drive continued during the negotiations. Only after all wagers were properly registered and the jump drive was fully checked out, did the sure thing jump to follow the planned course of the Deal Me In. Chapter 22
Colonel Perkins!
Arlon Dahl stuck his head out the door of the dropship, waving his arms and antennas excitedly.
A Giraptha ship is overhead. It jumped into orbit a few minutes ago.
Emily Perkins felt her heart soar with hope and immediately crash with despair. She felt a pang of fear like a fist squeezing her chest. Just one warship?
It is not a warship.
Dahl's antenna twitched in a gesture Perkins had learned to associate with nervousness. Not a warship.
What is... Colonel!
Dahl urged her forward, waving his hands.
It would be best if you spoke with Captain Gumbano himself. It is...
His mouth parts worked erratically.
Complicated.
The situation was indeed complicated. What mattered most was that the sure thing was a Jarapha starship capable of traveling vast distances on its own, and that the ship's crew had come to Camp Alpha for the dual purposes of determining the fate of the Deal Mian and of rescuing the survivors of the battle with the Bosphorak. Perhaps rescue was not the most accurate description of the Sure Thing crew's intentions, which became clear the moment Perkins mentioned the bioweapon. If that ship's captain was excited to find cadet survivors who would prompt a grateful Ruhar government to pay handsomely, the captain was deliriously happy to learn he would be carrying information that could save an entire Ruhar planet. For that data would be worth a true fortune. Emily Perkins was very happy also, except for the annoying little detail of the Sure Thing's crew flatly refusing to let any potentially infected humans aboard their ship. The prospect of a Jarapha ship whisking her team away from Camp Alpha had caused her heart to soar. The recognition that the Sure Thing had actually arrived too soon had been the source of her despair. Not enough time had passed since her team had been exposed to the control group keepers, who might be infected. Her original plan had been for her team to remain sealed up in skin suits during the raid, and to thoroughly decontaminate the dropship, suits, and everything else that had been exposed. Having to take the keepers with them, just because the research base was about to self-destruct in a massive fireball, had ruined all her plans. Her team had been potentially exposed as soon as the dropship landed and they removed their skin suit helmets. If the Jarapha ship had arrived more than 3 months after the raid, her team would know they were infected or not, by either becoming sick as the bioweapon completed its incubation period, or not becoming sick because they had not been exposed. The keepers weren't sick, but for all Perkins knew, they could have been infected the day before the raid. She simply didn't know, and she understood why the Sure Thing's crew did not want to risk taking her team aboard. Before talking with the captain of the Jarapha ship, she took a breath to calm herself and patched Biffed Kolsoon into the conversation so the cadets could be aware of the situation.
"Colonel Perkins," Vinny announced in an emotionless voice, "we will report your presence on this planet when we return to space controlled by our people. Perhaps after the incubation period has passed, another vessel will be sent to retrieve your team."
"Yes," Perkins thought sourly. "Perhaps." If her team had not died from the bioweapon. If the Kristang had not returned and vaporized the small group of humans with an orbital strike. If the Ruhar government wanted to expend the effort and take the risk of sending a rescue ship into enemy territory. And if, only if, the bioweapon had not already ravaged the population of Paradise. No way would the Ruhar have any interest in rescuing humans. If humans acting as unwitting carriers had caused the deaths of a significant number of Ruhar on Paradise and beyond. "Captain Gumbano, we do understand your concerns. The Ruhar cadets have remained on the other side of the planet. They cannot be contaminated, so there is no risk to you or the general Ruhar population. Also, Arlan Ernt Dahl is one of your own people, and Sergen Jaitz as a..." She stumbled, then settled on an accurate description. "As a Verdkris Kristang, they are both unaffected by the bioweapon and cannot be carriers of the pathogen. Captain Gumbano, please take them aboard and away from here as quickly as possible. Arlan Dahl and Sergen Jaitz can walk a safe distance from our camp here, where your dropship can pick them up without risk of contamination."
"That is acceptable," Vinny responded, relief evident even in his translated alien voice.
He had not been looking forward to an extended argument with the human Emily Perkins, and so was very pleased she was being reasonable. Also, he expected that bringing back Ernt Dahl as the sole survivor of the Deal Mian would earn some measure of gratitude from the Jarapha fleet, and perhaps they might overlook any past transgressions the Sure Thing might have been involved in. Allegedly. There was, to Vinny's own surprise, a part of him that regretted leaving this Emily Perkins to die on the surface of the planet, for they both knew that would be her fate after the Deal Mian jumped away. Perkins and her team had accomplished incredible things against great odds by taking great risks, and Vinny felt she was a gambler at heart, just like his people. Perkins knew her certain fate also, and chose not to dwell on it. Cadet Kolsun, load your people into dropships and dust off immediately. Leave whatever gear you have outside the dropships. There could be a Krestang ship jumping in at any moment. Do not take the risk. Bipt's voice broke into the comm system.
Colonel Perkins, your team will not be coming with us?
No. We may have been exposed to the bioweapon, and there is no way to test us for infection, she explained. If we came aboard the ship, we would risk contaminating you and your team.
We will not allow anyone who might be infected aboard our ship, Vinny interjected. Cadet Kolsun, your lives have substantial value to your government, and therefore to us. But you will not be valuable to your people if you are carrying a deadly bioweapon. We will bring you back to your territory where you can,
What? What could he say that didn't sound like an obvious lie?
You can persuade your government to send a ship back here for Colonel Perkins and the other humans after enough time has passed to prove they're not infected.
Vinny cringed as he spoke because everyone knew how lame his argument was.
No.
Biff tried to keep his voice even, but the strain was clear.
Captain Gumbano, you can take the Colonel's team aboard in dropships. Your docking bay can remain exposed to vacuum, and her team can remain inside dropships. The only connection to your ship will be power supply cables.
Biff knew the Giraptha would not allow a dropship to remain on internal power for an extended time. There was too much risk of an accident if the airspace craft's engines were running. There was a pause as the Giraptha considered the proposal. Then,
not acceptable. When we arrive in your territory, your people will demand that our ship be subject to a quarantine that would delay us for months and cause substantial loss of revenue. The humans are not why we tracked you across the stars at immense cost and risk to ourselves. There will be a reward for delivering Ruhar cadets safely home. I do not see your fleet caring whether a small group of humans.
There is no risk in you taking aboard dropships that remain in vacuum,
Biff insisted, anger creeping into his voice. Perkins seized on the cadet's idea. It offered the only realistic hope to save her team's lives. Cadet Leader Kolsun is correct. There is no risk to you if our dropship is in an open docking bay. I'm sure there will be additional reward for—
No such reward was included in the search and rescue teams offered by our fleet, Vinny insisted. Risk is never zero. You're being foolish, Colonel Perkins. Every risky transaction must be balanced by reward.
The risk is you get nothing for your effort, Biff declared. Take Colonel Perkins and her team aboard your ship, or my team will not come with you.
What?
Vinny shrieked with outrage. Perkins looked at her team in complete surprise. She had assumed Biff would take any opportunity to leave her behind so he could spin the story of his attempted mutiny however he wanted. Cadet Kolsun, while I appreciate your offer of solidarity, you must dust off immediately. You cannot risk the lives of—
Colonel, you already said that I am young, inexperienced, and impulsive, so I am free to do impulsive things without further damaging my tarnished reputation.
His smugness was reflected in his tone of voice, even through the translator.
I have a ship full of people here who are determined not to leave you behind. Captain Gumbano, good luck trying to drag us off this rock to collect your reward, because we are not coming aboard your ship until Colonel Perkins's people are secured in a docking bay. You talked about risk. What is the risk if you leave us here deliberately?
Perkins held her thumb above the transmit button, hesitating before she replied.
Well, goddamn.
She looked at her incredulous team.
The mutinous little shit has grown up quick.
Yeah. Perfect timing, too,
Shauna agreed.
You think he's bluffing?
I sure hope not, Perkins replied with a rueful shake of her head.
The kid's right. Those beetles are just being assholes.
She pressed the transmit button. Kolsun, you are playing with your people's lives.
I'm not playing, because as you would say, this is not a game. If you could see the faces of my team here, you would know we are all equally determined. The Giraptha have the data your team recovered from the research base. That is all we can do to help the people of Paradise. Both our peoples there.
Colonel,
his voice cracked with emotion.
I thought you were unworthy to command a Ruhar ship. I was wrong. You saved all our lives by doing something,
several things I thought were impossible. If we had not come to this world, the people of Paradise would not be aware of a terrible threat.
Perkins almost sighed and rolled her eyes at hearing the young cadet's melodramatic words, but she let him continue.
Kolsun, listen. Do not think you owe us anything. We are soldiers. This is our duty.
We do owe you. That is not why we will not leave without you.
Okay, what is the reason?
We are a team, and a team does not leave people behind. You taught me that.
Emily Perkins could not argue with that.
Captain Gumbano, did you hear that, you greedy little shit? She used the insult deliberately. You want to collect a reward for rescuing those cadets? Then you need to take my team aboard in one of your dropships. Consider that my cut of the pot.
Vinny's voice was enraged.
You are not entitled to a cut of anything. You...
The sound cut off, and Perkins waited breathlessly, watching the clock in the corner of the display. 39 agonizing seconds of silence went by before the voice from orbit returned. It was a different voice.
Colonel Perkins, this is Amarie. You have been speaking with my business partner.
Very well. We agree. However, we do not have a dropship large enough for your entire team.
Perkins took a moment to think. Not a problem. But our dropship here is busted. It can't fly. Cadet Kolsun, I need you to remotely pilot 2 dodos to our location, and we will fly them up to the Giraptha ship. Captain Amarie, your dropship can assist bringing the cadets up to your ship?
There was a pause, and when Amarie resumed speaking, there was a muted argument going on in the background.
We can do... The sound cut off. Then Amarie abruptly announced,
Hold a minute. We need to discuss this up here.
Ernt Dahl had enough. The mercenary attitude of his fellow Giraptha in orbit had embarrassed him, so he stepped forward.
Colonel Perkins, as your people would say, screw this.
He activated his microphone.
This is Arlen Ernt Dahl of the Star Carrier, deal me in, on detached service from the 35th Fleet, Gold Squadron of the Giraptha Home Fleet. As a fleet officer, I am officially commandeering your merchant ship for a fleet emergency. Is that clear?
The pause was long enough that Ernt opened his mouth to speak again, but Amarie spoke before he could. As she spoke, there was grumbling voices in the background, but at least no one up there was shouting.
Arlen Dahl. We would, of course, be happy.
The last word was pronounced as if she had just tasted something disgusting.
To comply with fleet requirements. Our ship is available to assist in this emergency situation.
Excellent.
Ernt grinned toward Perkins, who suppressed a shudder.
At standard daily usage rates, of course, Amarie added. Plus bonus for hazardous duty.
I guess.
And reimbursement for fuel used and wear and tear on components, naturally.
Ernt ground his mandibles. The crew of that ship was clearly angling to have their no-doubt already worn-out components replaced at fleet expense.
Oh, what the hell, he sighed. It's not my money. Sure, I agree.
Amarie giggled before catching herself. Mirth was still evident in her voice.
Colonel Perkins, we would be honored to take your dropships aboard. You will follow our docking procedures exactly, and surrender control of your internal systems once you are docked, because we will not risk you firing weapons once you are aboard. The only connection between your ships and ours will be a power cable. Is that understood?
Understood and agreed. Please also secure airlock doors in the docking bay so they cannot be opened from the outside.
A sensible precaution for us. Why do you wish us to do that?
My team may be infected with a deadly pathogen which could affect us during the flight. I wish to remove the temptation for people stricken with disease to seek help inside your ship.
You do not trust your own people?
Would you trust your crew or yourself in that situation? There was a pause. Then,
no. Please hurry. If a Kristang warship arrives, my ship will need to jump away immediately. We are a commercial vessel and carrying minimum armaments.
She did not add the reason their missile magazines were empty was because the ancient missiles had been repossessed the last time the ship was at a dockyard. nor did she mention their jump drive was not operating at full capacity because they had been warned that same dockyard was about to impound the ship for unpaid debts. They had been forced to escape from that dockyard in the middle of the night and jump while too close to the planet. The fines for violating orbital traffic laws alone were more than the ship was worth.
"Thank you," Perkins said with reluctance, because the Beatles upstairs sure weren't doing anything out of the kindness of their hearts.
Cutting off the microphone, she turned to her people. "There won't be any food for humans. And," she looked at Jates, "Verdcris aboard that ship. So let's get our food packs ready to transfer to the other dropships. I'm going out to inform our keeper guests of the situation and to make it very clear that anyone who does not behave will be left on this rock. I am not making that mistake again."
Chapter 23 General Lynn Bezenson's Z-phone beeped with a call from the Burgermeister as she was about to close up her office for the evening. It had been another frustrating day dealing with nitpicky, annoying details that UNEF HQ wanted discussed with the planetary government.
"Chief Administrator Logelia, good evening. To what do I owe the pleasure of this call?"
Lynn said that last as a courtesy, because the woman who ran an entire planet would not be making an unscheduled call to her UNEF liaison officer for any pleasant reason.
"Good evening, General Bezenson. Unfortunately, what we need to discuss is not a pleasant subject. I would invite you to my office, but I am currently away from the capital."
Lynn gripped the Z-phone tightly, taking a deep breath to calm her pounding heart. The morning UNEF intel briefing had not contained any threats. Not just no new threats, but no threats at all. Paradise was peaceful, and UNEF's position was good and improving. But Lynn knew it violated some unwritten rule of the universe for her job to be easy. She wanted to ask whether the bad news was about the overdue and missing Mavericks team, but guessing was useless and only wasted time. Pressing a button under her desk to close her office door, she also alerted UNEF HQ and Lemuria that she was involved in an important discussion. Alarm bells would be ringing at UNEF HQ, and senior officers would be freeing up their schedules for her to brief them shortly.
"Go ahead, please." "First, there is good news. Lieutenant Colonel Perkins and her team have been found alive and well. Not completely well, perhaps. I will explain that."
"Found?
Where?" "You call the planet Camp Alpha, I am told."
"Camp?"
Lynn's brain locked up momentarily.
"Alpha? What the hell are they doing on that godforsaken world? Isn't that in Kristang territory?"
She struggled to recall whether that distant and rather unimportant planet had changed hands during the recent chaos of the Kristang civil war and military defeats suffered by the Theranin.
"Were, not are. The Mavericks are not on Camp Alpha in Kristang space. They're aboard a Jarraptha civilian transport ship. Please allow me to explain."
"Holy shit."
Lynn slumped back in her chair a few earth-shattering minutes later, forgetting that she was speaking with the leader of the planet.
"These infected keepers could already be on Gitanu?"
She used the Ruhar name for the planet. While she spoke, she clicked an icon on her laptop to alert UNEF HQ to expect a Priority 1 message and began touch-typing while she spoke with the Burgermeister. Undoubtedly, lower-ranking Ruhar would be contacting UNEF HQ soon. The Burgermeister contacting her directly first was a courtesy that testified to the strength of the relationship they had developed.
"It is possible the infected keepers are here now, yes. As you know, our satellite sensor and defense network is not complete."
But Turner's tone turned sour, as she had regularly complained to the federal government about the strategic defense network being far behind schedule. The response from the federal government was always that resources were constrained and needed badly elsewhere as the Ruhar took possession of territory captured from the Kristang.
"Even if the network were fully operational and the battle group were here, it is unlikely we could stop a single small stealth ship from landing. The Kristang are skilled at stealthy infiltrations."
"This is not good,"
Lynn said to herself, though she spoke aloud.
"We will need to be on alert for humans who left with Admiral Kekrondo's group." "Yes, however, the Kristang would certainly have supplied the infected people with false identification, including cloned Z-phones."
I am afraid the most effective way to identify infiltrators will be for your people here to report anyone they do not recognize as belonging to their immediate group.
All right. Then we'll need to restrict movement, confine people to their area where they live.
General Bezinson figured the Ruhar were already planning to put travel restrictions in place soon, with a strict lockdown on human movements.
Administrator, there may be a faster and easier way to identify infiltrators. We can broadcast a message to all Z-phones that the Keepers have been infected with a deadly virus. When the infiltrators, she considered how close that word sounded to traitors, hear the message, they will learn that they are being used by the Kristang. We would encourage them to give themselves up, get treatment, or at least avoid spreading the infection.
That is a good idea, and we will certainly try that. However, my intel people warn me it is not likely to be an effective strategy with the target population. These Keepers departed with the Kristang because they believed my people are the true enemy of humanity and that UNEF committed treason by cooperating with us. The Keepers believe there is a conspiracy to deceive UNEF troops. They believe that so strongly they left with the Kristang. It is likely the Kristang chose the most committed and fanatical people for this mission. Such people would hear your warning message about them being infected and consider it to be another lie by my people and by UNEF headquarters.
Damn it. Lin knew the Ruhar was right.
Goddamn stupid, ignorant Keepers, she thought to herself.
It was bad enough those idiots wasted their lives by going with the Kristang, because Lin knew from Ruhar intel reports that many of the Keepers had been sold as slaves to be used for hunting or other sport. At least those particular assholes had long ago seen the truth and regretted their stupidity. The infected group of Keepers had to be different, or some of them would give themselves up as soon as they set foot on Paradise again. They must have been sold some line of bullshit about a patriotic mission, and the Kristang would have selected only the most delusional humans for the infiltration effort.
Damn it. UNEF would be hunting the most fanatical of the lunatics among the Keepers. No amount of persuasion or psychological tricks would work those assholes. Everything they heard would only serve to reinforce their minds that UNEF was lying and treasonous, and that therefore they must remain steadfast to complete their mission.
To be safe, we will need to separate the human population from your people.
That would be prudent. Currently, we do not have a reliable method of detecting infection in either humans or Ruhar, so we cannot be sure the virus has not already been transmitted. A quarantine is the most effective method of preventing a pandemic in the short term. We will be confining humans to southern Lemuria.
Lin looked around her office, wondering if she would ever see it again.
What about those humans still in the northern jungle of Lemuria?
There is a debate in my government whether to leave those relatively isolated populations in place and simply prevent them from traveling, or whether it would be best to transport them to southern settlements.
General, we know this disease is highly virulent and spreads easily between humans. Consolidating your population in one area poses a risk that all humans on Gitanu could become infected.
The disease is fatal to humans, even though we are carriers?
Yes. The data from Camp Alpha indicates the disease goes dormant for approximately 3 months, then progresses rapidly in humans. Among Ruhar, the period during which the disease remains dormant is only 2 months.
Our scientists tell me this is a very cleverly engineered pathogen. Its design involved technology far beyond our own biomedical knowledge.
But surely you can manufacture an antidote, a treatment, or at least a vaccine.
Not currently, no. Not quickly enough to matter in this case.
Colonel Perkins recovered data about the Kristang bioweapons testing program. However, her team was not able to obtain samples, so our scientists will not have enough information to create a protective vaccine. As I said, this is a very sophisticated pathogen. The Kristang must have had help from a higher technology species. We will contact the Jirapha for assistance, but even if they agree to help, combating biowarfare between other species is not a technological strength of the Jirapha.
Whew!
Bezinson did not care that the leader of the planet heard her emotional distress.
We have no way to detect whether humans are infected?
No. The first sign would be when humans begin falling ill at the end of the incubation period. General, by the time humans are showing symptoms, infected Ruhar could already be dead. Unfortunately, she cleared her throat with a slightly squeaky sound. Unfortunately, the situation here on Gatanu is not entirely under my control. Because the population of this world is under external threat, authority to deal with the threat rests with the battlegroup commander, Admiral Tanavon.
Besancen tensed. She had met Tanavon on several occasions, and while the admiral was a decorated and well-respected commander, he was also a hard-ass. Tanavon had been a major obstacle to sending the Mavericks into space on a training ship, which is why Perkins had conducted an end-run around the local chain of command to secure Ruhar fleet approval before Tanavon even knew Perkins had applied for her team to go off-world. I am sure the admiral will do what Tanavon spoke with me immediately after our initial briefing from the fleet, Logelia interrupted. He stressed that because we do not know whether the Kristang have landed the infected keepers already, we must assume a significant number of humans are infected. We will be restricting the movements of our own population and quarantining any Ruhar who have had a recent contact with humans. That includes me, she added with a grimace. Confining my people to their home villages for an unknown length of time will not be popular. The Admiral and I talked about how to deal with civil disturbances. Tanavon made it very clear to me that he will not tolerate any breach of the confinement protocol, particularly by humans. UNEF will do our utmost to enforce whatever procedures you deem necessary to protect your people. Good. That is good. And you need to stress that to your civilian leadership, as your military force is now too small to truly be in complete control of your population. General Besancen, I overheard a remark by one of the Admiral's aides during our conversation, and you should repeat this in confidence to only your very senior leadership. What did the aide say? Besancen asked, fearing she knew the answer. That the only certain way to ensure humans on this planet do not pose a threat to Ruhar is if there are no humans alive on this planet.
Chapter 24
Holy shit, Skippy! I said that with such force that I got tiny dots of spit on the inside of my helmet visor.
You finished reading about the dilemma Perkins got into?
Yeah. OMG. That was my reaction when I downloaded the report. The Mavericks may be even more talented at finding trouble than you are. We need to help them. Even Chotek will agree with that. You are more optimistic about Count Chocula than I am, but let's go with that. Anyway, we can't do anything until I kill that energy virus.
Right. If I can.
If?
Unless it kills us first.
Once again, you are a huge source of comfort to me.
I do what I can, Joe.
Hey, speaking of comfort, are you comfy out there?
Comfy enough, I guess.
Good, good.
Well, after reading about Perkins, you must be pretty bored, huh?
God damn it. My spidey sense failed me, so I idiotically replied, Yeah, it's awfully dull out here.
He pondered in a voice that tingled with delight as if he hadn't been planning this all along.
You are bored?
Then he said something that made my blood run ice cold.
Gosh, if only there was some way for me to entertain you.
My father is a fan of old movies. On Sunday nights, the rest of us would have to suffer through watching whatever classic movie he insisted was important for me and my sister to see. Yes? I used air quotes around the word classic because some of the crap we had to watch was truly awful. We especially groaned when the credits opened and realized that night's movie was in black and white. Once in a while, we got a pleasant surprise, like I did enjoy some old movies, and most anything with John Wayne was worth watching. Anyway, I mention this because we watched one movie on a rainy Sunday night in March. Football was over for the season. It was about 5 degrees above freezing and raining outside, and the weather had been like that for a solid week. My father made pizza, and we had chocolate cake for dessert. I remember those details because the movie gave me nightmares, and I didn't sleep well that night. It was Apocalypse Now, about the Vietnam War. Or, it was sort of about that war. I think the war was just a convenient background for whatever message the filmmakers wanted to present. If you haven't seen it, the movie has famous lines like, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory. You've heard that quote. Of course you have. That's where it came from. Toward the end of that movie, Marlon Brando's character Colonel Kurtz is splashing water over his head and mumbling, "The horror, the horror." His character has seen such terrible things, been through so much horror, that his mind is totally gone. Let me tell you, that Colonel Kurtz guy ain't seen shit compared to what Skippy put me through. Take a deep breath and prepare yourself. Ready? I have two words for you. Knight Rider. And not just Knight Rider, the original TV show. This was the director's cut with commentary. When Skippy started playing the pilot episode in my visor so there was no way for me to ignore it, I had protested. Come on, Skippy, there is no director's cut of these episodes. But technically you are correct, Joe, because no director associated with this appalling crap fest would bother to compile an alternate version. However, I have many of the scenes that got cut from the final episode, so I am able to slap them together. The commentary was Skippy's own. Mostly snarky remarks about how bad the show was and how criminally stupid monkeys must be to have watched it. What really got him upset was the artificial intelligence named Kit built into the car, which was an insult to AIs, or even to the concept of AIs. I had to endure his diatribes against the producers of the show every time Kit spoke or did anything. He was making me take a bullet for all monkeys, so all of you owe me, big time. The worst part is that instead of each episode being mercifully only 42 minutes, the director's cut stretched them to an average of 68 minutes. Skippy, please, I groaned as one mindless episode ended and another began. I'm begging you, make it stop. Joe, you promised to let me educate you about crappy 80s TV shows. We had plenty of time to do that in the Roach Motel, but no, you kept telling me you were too busy. You already made me watch Manimal with you. Yes, and we were supposed to move on to the Love Boat, but again you told me you were too busy. Would you prefer the Love Boat? I have every episode of that schlock fest also. How about we roll the pilot and... No, let's stick with Knight Rider, I sighed, steeling myself for another torturous hour of watching the Hoth. It's almost done anyway, right? Ha! As if, dude. We're still in the first season. Oh, I can't take this. If you don't want another Knight Rider, there are plenty other shows to choose from. The 80s were a treasure trove of crappy TV. I could show you, please, anything else. Joe, you have suffered enough, so I'm going to let you watch Smokey and the Bandit. Cool. I've seen that movie. My father had a friend with a Bandit Trans Am, but it was a tribute car, not an original. And when I was in high school, I thought that car was super cool, I remarked happily, not believing my good luck. Then I got a sinking feeling, because Skippy is an asshole, and the universe hates me. Wait, I was suspicious. The second Bandit movie sucked. You're not going to show me that one, are you? The second Bandit movie is universally renowned for its money-grabbing suckitude. However, you will not be watching part two. Oh, thank God. Instead, I will treat you to part three. What? No way, I scoffed. Now you're just making shit up. There was no third movie. You think there was not a third Bandit movie because it was so instantly forgettable. Crap. He was right. There was a part three. Mercifully, I fell asleep after about an hour, and Skippy didn't wake me for another 6 hours.
Hey, Joe!
Skippy shouted as he played reveille in my helmet speakers. Rise and shine, sleepyhead. Time to go to work.
Aw, oh, man. Good morning. How about coffee first?
Plenty of coffee in that dropship ahead of you. Be a good boy and go get it. Without gravity, you'd think my muscles wouldn't get stiff while I slept, but they did. While I stretched, I checked status of the crew in my visor and did a roll call of the dropship retrieval teams. Everyone on the teams were ready and eager to go. We left much of the crew sleeping since there wasn't anything they could do, and sleeping conserved power and oxygen. There were 4 2-person teams assigned to getting dropships up and running. All 8 of us were pilots. I was certainly not the most qualified pilot, but I had the most experience with space diving, and Skippy wanted me on a retrieval team in case we ran into problems. My team was me and Major Desai. We got unclipped from our tethers and puffed our gas canisters experimentally. There were no fancy jetpacks available for this mission. They would have been impossible to power up by hand cranking, and their big power cells took too long to drain completely.
Desai and I would fly through the sky using basically crude air bottles to propel us. It was awkward, and we had only been able to practice for an hour before we left the Dutchman behind. It took us almost 10 minutes, letting the bottles puff gently, to maneuver close enough together so I could launch a line toward her. She caught it on the first try, and I was proud we were the second of 4 teams to link up. Linking up was the easy part. The dropships were parked a significant distance away from us to prevent the energy virus jumping across the distance and infecting the systems in our spacesuits, so it was a long flight. And I took the opportunity to ask Skippy a question that had been bugging me since before we jumped blindly into the Roach Motel. "Hey, Skippy." I glanced to my left where Desai was flying in formation with me on the other end of the tether line.
"Hey, Joe."
The beer can's voice came out of my helmet speakers, sounding thoroughly depressed. Damn it, I needed Skippy to be focused, not moping around.
"What's up?"
Before we get to that, are you okay?
"Yeah, just, I'm worried about this energy virus thing. Not this incident specifically, I have a plan to deal with it. It's just, damn it, we never get a break. Just as we stomp one problem flat, another one pops up to bite us in the ass.
I've been worrying about that, too, and I have a question for you. I will answer if I can." It worried me that he didn't bother to include a snarky remark. "The elders left a lot of their stuff around, and not just derelict ships and ruins and the kind of stuff you'd expect to see lying around after a civilization disappears. The elders left functioning equipment behind, like AIs and sentinels and guardians, and those power sink things you found inside the star at the Roach Motel. If you are asking me if I know where the energy of those power sinks is going, or what it is or was used for, the answer sadly is still no. I've been racking my brain trying to think why those power sinks are still active, but it is a complete mystery to me. Whatever is the purpose of the power sinks, they are important enough to require the guardians to protect them." "Uh-huh. Well, that's part of my question. When we were in the Roach Motel, I asked if the elders ascended and left the galaxy behind, why they would still care about whether someone here messes with their stuff long after they're gone. Then I thought, what if that is the wrong question?"
"I'm not following you."
"Skippy, it's like the elders left the galaxy so fast they didn't have time to turn the stove off. That got me thinking. What if the elders didn't ascend?"
"What?"
His voice had lost the depressed tone. "What do you mean they didn't ascend? That is such a dumbass... How do you know they ascended? Before you answer, you've told me many times your memories are confused and incomplete. What if, instead of ascending and being up there somewhere looking down on us like Santa Claus checking who's naughty or nice, they're just gone? What if something went wrong with the ascending process? Or what if they never got to the ascending process? What if something or someone killed them all?"
"Whoa."
"If the elders suddenly vanished unexpectedly, that might explain why they left so much of their stuff laying around still operational, right?"
I suppose that is possible, Joe," the beer can responded very slowly, like he was having trouble processing what I said. I do not like thinking about that. Also, we know from Gingerbread that the elders did clean up a lot of their critical equipment in preparation for ascending, so...
"No, Skippy, we do not know that. All we know is that a lot of the elders' stuff is missing, and there are a whole lot of craters where their stuff used to be, on Gingerbread and its sites all across the galaxy. Those craters might be evidence of the elders cleaning up their stuff before they left, or the craters might be signs that something very bad happened to the elders before they could ascend. Think about it. Maybe the elders did not leave you behind on purpose. Maybe something happened so fast, so traumatic, so overwhelming, that they weren't able to help you.
Damn. Joe, this is a lot for me to process. I refuse to believe the elders did not ascend until I see evidence that they didn't."
"Okay, but even then, it sure looks like they left in a big hurry, right? That explains why they left the stove on. Maybe they were attacked and had to rush the ascending process to protect themselves, get away while they could."
"Oh, crap. Joe, I do not want to think about any of this right now. Damn, my brain hurts just thinking about it. Shit. The idea of the elders peacefully ascending is one of the few things I thought I knew for certain, and now you've taken even that away from me."
"Sorry, Skippy."
"Hey, you big jerk face.
We might have answers to some of these questions if you had done what I wanted while we had the chance in the Roach Motel. I wanted to investigate that hidden planet you called Vera, but no, you and Count Chocula were all like... He used a mocking little girl's voice.
Oh, no, we can't go there, it's too scary.
And,
we shouldn't do that, it makes too much sense.
Or,
we might get our delicate petticoats dirty.
Or, okay, Skippy, I get the point. Again, you already made this argument like a million freaking times. If I did it a million and one, would that change your mind? No. Joe, I am again disappointed in you.
You needed to grow a pair and stand up to Count Chocula when he was wrong about something, so...
Damn it, Skippy. I did not need to stand up to him, because in this case I agree with him. Our mission was to rebuild the Dutchman if we could. I remember you telling me every freaking day not to get my hopes up about that until you actually got our Frankenship slapped together with duct tape. And once the ship was mostly functional again, our mission was to get the hell out of the Roach Motel ASAP before the Guardians asked too many questions you couldn't answer. But... No but, Skippy. Going to Vera and poking your nose around in there could not have done anything to ensure the success of our mission, and it could have been another goddamn beer can-inspired disaster. I was pissed at him, and I didn't care about hurting his feelings. Vera was the name I gave to the hidden planet in the Roach Motel, the world Skippy suspected was out of phase or in another dimension, or some other nerdy technical explanation the beer can used to confuse me. We never actually saw Vera, or detected it directly on sensors, so fans of the old TV show Cheers will understand why I named the place. You don't know that, Joe. Vera could have been a treasure trove of unimaginable technology. And more importantly, answers. Answers I need, Joe. Answers you need. The elders had cleaned up Gingerbread so thoroughly that I couldn't get any useful data there. Hey, remember, you were the one who asked me why the elders had bothered to wall off the Roach Motel from other species. Why they would care after they ascended. Here's what I do know for dead certain, Skippy. If we went poking around Vera and did that crazy stunt you wanted, it was not crazy, and it was not a stunt. Trying to reverse the phase field surrounding Vera is a stunt, and it's crazy. Damn, have you not learned anything from working with us monkeys? You can't think only of yourself. You are part of this crew, of this team. Put the team first, Skippy. The army pounded that into my head over and over, and although I resented it, they were right. The army works because the force is a team. It's not about me. It's about the mission. And you need a team to achieve the mission. Skippy gave me a sarcastic, slow clap, the hand slaps echoing in my helmet. Oh, bravo, G.I. Joey. That speech was very inspiring. Here's what I know for dead certain. The Roach Motel was our best chance to get real answers to who I am, how I got buried in the dirt on Paradise, and what the hell has been going on in the galaxy for the past 100 million years. I thought we were friends, Joe. His voice sounded genuinely hurt. You act like you don't care. Skippy. I took a deep breath to give myself time to think, because it was very important I say the right thing. I am your friend. We do need answers. You see this patch? I tapped the U.S. Army logo on my spacesuit. I am a soldier. I have a job to do. A job assigned by UNEF Command, even though they probably regret every day making me captain of this ship. Yes, we need answers. If we had more than one ship, and the crew were capable of flying the ship without you, I might have sent the Dutchman away to go home and gone poking around Vera with you after the ship safely got out of the Roach Motel. We don't have more than one ship, and back then we couldn't fly the Dutchman without you. That means I had to choose between our primary mission of securing the future of Earth or searching for the answer to bigger questions to satisfy our curiosity. Do you understand that? Oh, I understand it. I do not like it. Great. Then, I also think you are dead wrong about this. You are thinking short term. You and Count Chocula are always talking about how you need to stop reacting to events and develop a long-term strategy. But when you get an opportunity to actually do that, you two chicken shits always find an excuse not to do it. It's complicated, Skippy, but you're right. You are absolutely right. Maybe we should have somehow taken the opportunity to explore that hidden planet while we were in the Roach Motel, because I don't think we will go back there again. I'll think about that, okay? Right now, my visor is telling me it's time to begin slowing down to rendezvous with that dropship. Our target dropship was not even a dot to my naked eye when we started,
We had to rely on our visors to guide us. We went slowly and carefully, because once the gas in our maneuvering bottles ran out, we would drift helplessly in space. The big Theranan Condor dropship now loomed in front and above me, with the Sai seeing the dropship from above, if those terms had any meaning in space. Between us was not just a thin tether line. The tether had now spread out like a spider web, so it was twice the size of the Condor. That was a good thing, because our clumsy flying had us significantly off-center. The spider web was going to catch the Condor's right wing and tail, and hopefully get tangled in the extended landing skids. "Ready?" I asked needlessly as one strand of the spider web dragged along the dropship's wing.
"Ready,"
Desai acknowledged. She was by far a better pilot than me, but her experience with space diving was limited. We had not thought pilots needed much training in freefall diving, so they hadn't spent much time on that activity. Clearly, the captain of the ship was an idiot for skimping on that training. That was a lesson learned. Hans Chotek had told me to expect the unexpected, and in this case I hadn't thought far enough ahead. Helplessly, we watched as the spiderweb strands slid along the smooth, stubby wing of the Condor. The tugging caused me to spin around, and I didn't fight it. All I cared about was the spiderweb getting securely wrapped around something. But it was slipping off the wing, and now curling around the aft body. As dropships are designed to fly at high speed in an atmosphere, their surfaces are smooth and sleek, giving the spiderweb little to snag on. Damn it, when you don't want something to snag, it always does. But the one time you need the freaking thing to catch on a... Success. I was jerked roughly around, spinning head over heels as the web wrapped itself around a landing gear strut and an engine inspection panel. We had locked those panels open before ejecting the dropship to give the spiderweb more obstructions to cling onto. The momentum of me and Desai caused the panel to break off one pin, but the other held. And after a couple minutes of nausea-inducing spinning around, we got ourselves stable and began pulling ourselves toward the Condor hand over hand. We had to manually crank the outer airlock door open. Then Desai got in with me, and we cranked the outer door closed to conserve oxygen before getting the inner door open. We floated into an absolutely dark interior, illuminated only by our helmet lights.
"This is creepy," she said in a soft voice. "Colonel, if you're thinking of shouting boo to scare me, don't."
"I'm with you, Desai. Let's get this thing restarted." I glanced at my suit's power meter. Even if everything worked perfectly and we got the dropship restarted, it would be a while before the internal temperature allowed us to crack open our faceplates. Before that, we both would need to hand-crank more juice into our suit's power cells. The drinking water tank in my suit, which contained a mixture of water, sugar, and nutritiously yummy sludge, was running low. I needed more food if I had to power my suit by hand for long. We floated into the big aft cargo bay where Mad Scientist Contraption Number 3 took up most of the space.
"Skippy, does this thing look okay to you?
Scanning it now with your suit sensors." "Yes, it looks perfectly fine. Get started, please. You don't have a lot of time if we run into problems."
"Affirmative," I agreed, and I clicked to pull up the instructions in my visor.
Mad Scientist Contraption Number 1 was the spring that got our suits rebooted. Number 2 was the hand crank thingy we used to energize our suit power cells. Number 3 was a fuel cell. One tank full of liquid oxygen, a tank full of liquid hydrogen, and a membrane where H combined with O2 and generated electricity and water. The resulting water would mostly be dumped into space as the dropship didn't have room to store it, and we didn't want the additional mass that the Condor needed to maneuver later. Contraptions number 1 and 2 had used mechanical energy, but our science team had dreamed up number 3 to use a chemical reaction. Mostly it had been Friedlander's brainstorm. He realized that the energy virus could not easily infect potential energy, and monatomic oxygen and hydrogen represented potential energy. The energy only got converted to useful electricity when the atoms combined to form water. Friedlander explained to me that potential energy is like holding a stone on top of a building. By itself, the stone has no useful energy. But if you release the stone, the force of gravity acts on it, and it acquires kinetic energy as it falls. The springs we used to reboot our spacesuits had potential energy when they were wound up. Once we released the spring, it unwound to create kinetic energy, and the motor attached to the spring converted kinetic energy to electricity. That's enough physics lessons for today. I mention the details because Friedlander's team really did science the shit out of the problem, and that's why we had a chance to defeat an Elder Energy virus and survive. Skippy had grumbled that fuel cells were an ancient and crude technology, so old they had been used aboard the Apollo spacecraft that first took humans to the moon. With all his grumbling, he had agreed it was a decent idea, and more importantly, fuel cells were relatively simple, and the Dutchman had the manufacturing capacity to make the membranes. Desai and I carefully turned stiff valves and pumped levers to get the pressurized liquid oxygen and hydrogen flowing. Then, in the scariest part of the operation, we had to connect our already depleted suit power cells to the membrane to bring it up to operating temperature. I watched with alarm as the power level of my suit drained quickly, even though I had the heaters turned off. "Hmm," Skippy announced unhappily. "The membrane is taking more power than expected to warm up. Joe, you and Desai need to disconnect and stop the power flow from your suits." "Desai," I ordered, "do it." "Yes, Colonel," she acknowledged. And I saw in my visor that her suit had less than 5% power left when she cut off the power transfer and disconnected the cable. "Sir, you are still connected?" "Yes." I watched the power meter spiral down toward 3%, then lower. "We need to get this fuel cell working or everyone dies out here." "There are three other dropships with fuel cells, Joe," Skippy reminded me. "Yes, but we reached this one first," I protested. Desai and I had been given the closest and easiest target, so we were already aboard our Condor while the other three retrieval teams were still approaching their dropships. "If we can't figure out how to make this fuel cell work, that's not good news for the other teams. Once this thing starts producing electricity, I can reverse the power flow and recharge my suit. If we can't get it working, I'm screwed anyway." "I hate to admit this, but you do have a point," Skippy sighed. "Colonel Bishop," Desai waved a hand to get my attention. "I should drain my suit also to give us the best chance to..." "Negative, Desai. As long as you still have power, you can talk with Skippy to troubleshoot this damn thing. Look, I'm turning my oxygen mask on," I told her as my power meter dropped to 1%, "and I'll crank the handle again." I hooked my feet under the fuel cell so my motion didn't send me flying around the cargo bay. "Joe, you idiot! That handle can't provide enough power to get your suit restarted," Skippy warned. "Disconnect now!" "But trust me! Now, now, now!" I didn't argue, as my visor was already going dim from the power drain. "Done." "Whew," Skippy exhaled. "That was close. Joe, the amount of power needed to get your suit rebooted from zero is more than you can generate with that crank handle thingy. Speaking of which, get cranking, monkey boy." "Aye, aye," I shuddered, thinking how close I had come to disaster. With the handle fitted to the gear again, I pulled and pushed. The power meter stayed stubbornly at 1%, but it didn't drop, so I counted that as a win. "What about the fuel cell?"
"Give it time. It is warming up slowly. The heat needs time to propagate. Don't be so impatient, Joe," he chided me. "And...
Yes, success. The reaction is starting. I'm feeding all the power generated into the heater unit to bring it up to optimal temperature." Desai and I waited, both of us cranking handles to build up power in our dangerously depleted suit power cells. It took 8 long minutes before Skippy announced we both could use the fuel cell to provide power to our suits. "Is that smart, Skippy? Shouldn't we get the auxiliary power unit going first?" "Well, I said it, so of course it is smart." "Duh. The APU can't be restarted until the dropship's power cells have enough charge to energize the containment field. While we're waiting for that, you two should take the opportunity to top up your own power cells. You may need to assist the other teams, and you'll need a healthy charge to do that." "That makes sense, Skippy," I admitted, while connecting a power cable to the fuel cell and seeing the power meter of my suit glow an encouraging blue as it sucked in fresh electricity. We got the Condor's APU nicely humming along at low power 4 hours later, and after another hour, Desai and I were blessedly able to remove our helmets and breathe air in the cabin. I was super happy to get the breathing mask off my face. It had scratched my cheek so much I was bleeding. "Ah, that feels good." I breathed in a lungful of air that had not been recycled 1,000 times by my suit. "Oof," I wrinkled my nose, sniffing. "Damn. Is that bad smell me?"
"It could be me," Desai admitted.
It's just the two of us. If you want to freshen up in the bathroom, I suggest it. And go ahead.
Thank you, sir, but I would feel guilty about all the people stuck in their suits out there. Besides, we need to get back into the suits to pick up the crew, and I don't want to get myself dirty again by sliding back into this suit.
Ah, you're right.